It's the 3rd of February 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. What the hell is wrong with blasphemy? Do cuts to disability benefits make the word welfare a deeply ironic portmanteau? Does the Unilad fiasco make denouncing the kids of today a legitimate activity? And is nuclear war still on the cards, or is the Cold War just heavy water under the bridge now? But before we begin, the traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do consider going over to our website and making a one-off donation, or subscribing to donate £5 or £10 a month. It's roughly equivalent to buying us a couple of drinks a month. That's all, that's poddelusion.co.uk. But first, we start the show this week with some blasphemy, goddammit! And last weekend, the air in Conway Hall in London was turned blue during a conference organised by the Centre for Inquiry UK. You can hear podcasts of some of the talks on the Pod Delusion Extra feed. If you've listened to our programme recently, you'll know that blasphemy is something of a hot topic at the moment, after a number of university atheist societies in London have been accused of Islamophobia. In the case of LSE, the accusation actually came from their student union. So as I say, it's a bit of a hot topic in our little world. And as such, the conference was the place to be, so we spoke to some of the people there about blasphemy and some related issues. First, we spoke to Andrew Copson, the chief executive of the British Humanist Association, who delivered a talk about the role of advertising regulations in censorship. We started by asking him, why advertising?
Well, I concentrate on the Advertising Standards Authority because I think it's one of the least known examples of the suppression of legitimate free speech. You know, the adverts that I show today with the naked priests and pregnant nuns and all those other excellent examples were all banned in what is really the imposition of an arbitrarily decided code in a system that is difficult to appeal against. The adverts that we saw, which never even appeared because they were pre-banned, in effect, by the advice of the CAP, we'll never see. And we'll never know that we're not seeing them. And you can't appeal against the decision of the CAP because it's not really a decision, even though everyone abides by it. So I think it's an emerging campaign for the BHA, certainly in this coming year, is challenging the whole regulatory regime around advertising, which is having such a chilling effect on free speech and really reintroducing blasphemy laws by the back door.
So do you think there's anything we can do as just general consumers to help stop this backdoor censorship?
I guess buy all the ice cream that's advertised by those sexy priests and pregnant nuns. And it's difficult because by its very nature, the system of advertising regulation admits of only one side. Like, you can make a complaint and it's adjudicated on by the Advertising Standards Authority. It's not the case that someone makes a complaint and then the Advertising Standards Authority advertises for anyone who would like to rebut that complaint and you have a chance to enter the adversarial ring and do battle for the cause that you agree with. So it's difficult. I think that that's one of the complications we'll be looking at to develop as we develop the campaign this year. What are the ways, actually, that we can bring public pressure to bear? I think probably the first thing we'll have to do is talk to the SA about their own code. Talk to government about it, look with some lawyers at perhaps seeing if some of the decisions are judicially reviewable. And in some of those instances, of course, there'll be things that, you know, you and I can do as individuals to support that campaign. But I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we even know yet what that might be.
So if, for example, you wanted to put a poster advert saying the ASA is shit and then asked the CAP if that would be okay, what do you reckon they'd say?
I think they'd say it's okay as long as you didn't say holy shit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we spoke to Mariam Namazi from the One Law for All campaign, who's gone as far as organising a rally in defence of free speech. So we asked her, why is a rally necessary?
Well, I mean, I think the rally is important for two reasons. One is that atheist student groups don't feel alone, you know, because they are being bullied. They're being bullied, they're being intimidated, and they're being called all sorts of things for merely posting a Jesus and Mo image on their Facebook page or for expressing their beliefs. You know, so in that sense, I want to give them a sense that they're not alone. There are a lot of people who support them, who'll defend their right to free expression. There are a lot of ways in which you can defend free expression, but I do think going out on the streets is important as well. You know, it's, you know, a lot of changes in the world didn't take place place behind closed doors with, you know, people in power discussing things. It happened because there was so much pressure on the streets that things changed for the better. And I think, you know, this is one way of defending free expression. So I do urge everyone to come. If we are really a majority, which I believe, can we please see it on the streets for a change?
I want to ask you about, I thought it was particularly fascinating about your speech earlier. I could relate to it a lot when you were talking about how the far left seem to have sort of got into bed with extremist Islam. And I mean, why do you think that those two groups have seemed to have got together in such a way?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is, of course, their position on anti-imperialism. They're anti-imperialist. They see Islamism being anti-imperialist, which is not true at all. In fact, if you look at the history of contemporary Islamism, it was created by US foreign policy as a green belt against the Soviet Union at the time. You know, so in that sense, Islamism and US-led militarism are two sides of the same coin. They intervene in Iraq, Iraq becomes more Islamic than it was. They intervene in Afghanistan, they want to bring the Taliban back, you know, and they're negotiating with them. So it's you know, they can't see beyond their noses, really, when they think that it's an anti-imperialist force. It's actually reactionary. Plus, the whole idea of my enemy's enemy is an ally is bogus, really, because if you don't start with principle, you end up going into bed with hideous, hideous movements like Islamism. And I wouldn't call them left. I'm on the left. They are right-wing, and they are defending a right-wing movement that is massacring people left, right, and center. And so I think we need to bring out the real left and real progressive movement that is against US-led militarism, but also against Islamism, and defends people's rights, irrespective of their beliefs or lack of.
Do you see a lot of hope in the Arab Spring, then?
I mean, I do. I know people are calling it an Arab winter, and I think that what's happened is very similar to what happened in Iran, where a left-leaning revolution was actually suppressed and expropriated by the Islamic movement. It's very natural that Islamic parties will be able to gain political power, given the fact that they are very well organized and they have huge amounts of backing. We don't have that with secularist forces. The movement we've seen in Iran after the fraudulent elections a few years back, plus the Arab Spring, has been a movement of people wanting freedom and wanting a life different than the ones that they lived under. They never wanted Islamism. And I think it's a disservice to those people if we say, well, they wanted Islamism, they voted for Islamism, and that's that. We need to carry on supporting secular forces in the region.
You can find links to details about the rally on February the 11th on the Pod Delusion website. Finally, we spoke to the philosopher Austin Dacey, who's also the ambassador to the UN for the International Humanist and Ethical Union. I started by asking him if attempts to pass a blasphemy resolution at the UN is actually a threat to our free speech.
One would think that the UN would be the first defender of the human right to blaspheme, but as we've seen and as we've heard from talks today, since at least 1999, there's been a very concerted effort right at the citadel of the human rights system, at the Human Rights Council, to oppose this right. Now, some would say that these resolutions are empty and so harmless, but I think they're much worse. First, the UN continues, for better or for worse, to have a kind of moral authority around the world. And so these resolutions, and especially the concessions made to them by the West, they bear the moral imprimatur of the United Nations, and so legitimize the repression of peaceful speech and political dissent and religious minorities under authoritarian regimes. Not long ago, when Pakistan was arguing for some language to oppose the defamation of religions, as they call it, the representative cited the recently passed blasphemy law in Ireland, taking their language chapter and verse, saying, quite understandably, you know, if a blasphemy law is good enough for a secular democratic Ireland, it should be good enough for Pakistan.
From your perspective, having worked at the UN and with the UN, does anyone there recognise the irony in all of these really nasty regimes sitting on the Human Rights Council?
So it's a parody. It's a parody of itself. I mean, there was a committee being chaired. It was a committee to elaborate complementary standards, as it's called, to the treaty combating racism. It was chaired by Libya. Unfortunately, this body is completely political, and it's utterly divided along political lines, and the OIC countries, along with their allies in the non-aligned group of developing countries, and Russia, and China, and Cuba, they can essentially do whatever they want.
Mm. Previous in the past, we've covered things like UN resolutions dealing with things like access to medical care in terms of abortion and contraception and things. Are these the same kind of blocks that are coalescing around these issues, like blasphemy and reproductive rights, for example?
Yes, I think that's nowhere more pronounced than with the battle for LGBTQ rights at the UN. Amazingly, the Human Rights Council and its predecessor, the Commission on Human Rights, had never in its history passed a resolution condemning intolerance and violence against gays and lesbians and transgender people until last year. So this was a huge pitched battle, and something that I've been following recently is the committee within the UN that decides which civil society organizations are admitted to the table to be stakeholders, to make statements, and to represent their constituencies. There were gay and lesbian groups that had been applying for affiliation with the United Nations for up to 10 years, being repeatedly deferred on bogus queries about their organization. I actually heard the Pakistani representative deny affiliation to a gay and lesbian organization until that they could prove that homosexuality was genetic. Unless and until they could do that, it clearly wasn't a human rights issue. It was a matter of lifestyle and choice. So these are the kinds of tactics that surround, you're right, not just religion, but anything that that violates their narrow ideologies.
So I guess finally bring it down to the topic today. Is there any hope in the future? Does blasphemy have a future?
The future is bright. It's a struggle. Mm. It's a global struggle. I spoke today about a recent general comment by the Human Rights Committee, which does have some role in interpreting the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is the most important international human rights treaty. The committee last year came out very strongly against blasphemy laws. There certainly is a new awakening within the Western democratic countries at the UN. There's a very powerful coalition in civil society now to turn back the agenda of the OIC. And most significantly, of course, we see a kind of regional awakening in the Arab Spring, and allied with the opposition movement in Iran. I think what's necessary to secure the future for peaceful blasphemy and religious dissent and satire is for secular people in the West to make common cause with those secular dissidents, but also religious minorities living under authoritarian rule, who are, as I say, the very first victims of these laws.
You can hear some of the speeches from the day in full on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, over the last week, you may have followed the government's attempts to cut welfare benefits, which will obviously affect the disabled. In fact, according to Political Scrapbook, on the same day the government tried to cut benefits for disabled kids, David Cameron apparently hosted a party at Number 10 for children in need. Now, I'm not saying he might have got the wrong end of the stick or anything, or that he likes it when children are in need. But all I'll say is, do we actually know how Pudsey got that bandage? Anyway, last weekend, whilst I was at the Blasphemy Conference concerning myself with spiritual matters, our next contributor, Stephen Sumter, was concerned with matters decidedly more temporal, as he'd chained himself up in the middle of Oxford Circus. As you do, I guess. To explain exactly why, here's Stephen.
Did you hear about a group of disabled people who chained themselves together in Oxford Circus last weekend to protest against the Welfare Reform Bill? I was one of the people involved. I'm going to tell you about my day at that protest, but before that, I want to quickly run through some of the problems with the Welfare Reform Bill so that you know why I was protesting. It isn't so much that disabled people are going to get less money as that vast numbers of people will suddenly get nothing at all. The £26,000 a year benefit cap that has been in the news is the least of the problems as far as I am concerned. I'm more worried about the disabled children that will no longer be treated as having national insurance contributions and so won't get ESA when they are older. And I'm worried about the reduced disabled children's tax credits. And I'm worried about the charging parents to access the child support agency if they break up, which means that children will not get support or parents will stay in abusive relationships because they can't afford to leave. I'm worried about the fact that people receiving personal independence payments, or PIP, which will replace DLA, will be tested frequently, even if they have a progressive degenerative disease that will never get better, or even if they are missing limbs or permanently blind. PIP assessments will cost a fortune, are largely pointless for these people, and speaking from experience, assessments for ESA and DLA have a serious impact on health in themselves. I'm worried about the fact that DLA has a 0.5, yes that's 0.5% fraud rate, more is lost in error by the state, but that PIP will cut 20% off the budget. A budget that pays for all sorts of things, including wheelchairs and care and special food and walking sticks. When people are left without PIP, and they will be, that's the point of the government reforms, they will be stranded at home, dependent on friends and volunteers for help. I could go on, but that will do for now. So, on to my day of protest. My alarm went off at 6:30 a.m. Being a chronic insomniac, it was pure luck that I had actually managed to get some sleep by about 2 a.m, and so had had some sleep beforehand. And so I forced down a double dose of painkillers and coffee, and managed to get washed and dressed, no small feat for me at any time of day. Then I bundled myself into my power chair, and we were off. First stop was a bus into Evesham. Karen and I walked to the bus stop and waited in the cold. Eventually, the bus arrived and we travelled 20 minutes or so into town. Then we had to go half a mile from the bus station to the train station. I had pre-booked assistance to board the train, but hadn't been able to book the tickets, so we went via the ticket office to get some. £74 worth of tickets, which went on credit. Protest is costly, and in more ways than one. After some time in the very cold waiting room, since people in wheelchairs are told to arrive half an hour before the train is due, as well as to book 24 hours in advance, the train arrived. Unfortunately, when I found the space which I had been booked into, it turned out to be beyond the end of the platform. The train manager took us all the way to the other end of the train so that he could put us in first class where there was another wheelchair space. The next hurdle was that there was hardly any room to manoeuvre on the way into the train, and my chair got stuck trying to get past the luggage space. I had to get out of the chair, and the train manager actually lifted it clear of the obstruction, all 90 kilograms of it. In London, I got off the train after a brief delay while the ramp was taken to the wrong end, and we made our way out to catch a bus to our meet-up location. I have to say that I'm very impressed with the wheelchair ramps on London buses. There was a button next to the middle door to alert the driver of a wheelchair, and then after passengers have disembarked, the doors close again while the motorised ramp is lowered. Then the doors open and allow the wheelchair to board, with plenty of space to get to the designated wheelchair spot. I wish these buses were everywhere. We got to the branch of McDonald's where we were meeting. We were far earlier than we needed to be, but we started to bump into other people arriving for the protest anyway. After a few minutes, I met and talked to one of the organisers of our protest about our plan. The number of wheelchairs and other disabled people hanging around outside was making us a bit conspicuous, so he suggested that we go to meet up with another group a short distance up the road. I was really pleased to find people from UK Uncut waiting there to assist us, including some people that I had been talking to over the internet for more than a year, but had never met. Just before 12, we all moved off along Regent Street towards Oxford Circus. Volunteers from UK Uncut waited for the lights to go red and then ran across the crossing with a chain and locked it at both ends. A line of disabled people followed quickly and took up their places along the chain. I was near the end of the line as I was waiting for Karen to return with food for me, so I rolled into place right at the end of the line across Regent Street, actually still on the pavement. We all locked onto the chain with D-locks and cheered. We'd done it. After that, events were very hectic and a bit of a blur, to be honest. Being on the end of the line, I was prime target for hordes of journalists. I did interviews with more than I can remember. I did pieces to camera, for podcasts, radio. I talked to journalists, scribbling notes, to people from the BBC, The Guardian, The Times, LBC. I talked constantly for 2 hours and my head was spinning. Throughout the protest, people from UK Uncut and others constantly checked if we were okay, offered tea and coffee, and kept us updated with what the police were doing. Two police vans stopped in front of the line, blocked us from the rest of the junction, and a row of police lined up in front of the vans facing us. Some of them did try to take down a banner that was being held across the top of a tube entrance, and there was a Met cameraman carefully videoing us all. As we got near 1:30, it seemed like the police were getting a bit impatient. They informed some of our group that they would tolerate us if we moved aside to only block one side of the road, otherwise they would take appropriate action. By the time the police had made their feelings on this matter known, many of us were quite cold and uncomfortable anyway. This protest was extremely draining for most of the people involved. Although many of us wanted to stay until forced to move, the fact is that most of us could not, and so we all agreed that we would leave at 2 p.m. In the end, it was really chaotic. We all unlocked from the chain and a speech was made, but then no one knew quite which way we were going. Some people had mentioned adjourning to a pub to get warm and to get food, but as no one knew which pub, that didn't happen very quickly. We actually ended up milling around in the road and chatting until the police started to look a bit stern. We had a lovely time in the pub and I met more people who I previously knew only through Twitter. I stayed far too long for my own health, but I'd already condemned myself to days in bed, in pain and not moving, and this was an extremely rare opportunity for me to meet people, so I pushed through with help from lots of painkillers. Eventually, we left the pub and returned to Paddington Station. When we went to find our pre-booked assistants to board the train, the manager told us that Evesham Station was unmanned after lunchtime, which we knew, but he also didn't think there would be any staff on the train who could place the wheelchair ramp for me instead of the station staff. This made me panic a bit, but the station manager called another manager who called the train driver, who thought there might be staff on board after all. I went to board the train, which is where we discovered the train did not have a wheelchair space at all. I was really uncomfortable, so I moved to a seat next to Karen, and after Oxford I moved to a double empty seat where I tried to stretch out to relieve some pain. I crashed completely at that point, with horrific burning and aching pain in spite of my strong painkillers. I was in so much pain that I was crying on the train and trying to hide it from the other passengers. And here we are. I couldn't get out of bed for the first 48 hours. This is all completely in line with what I expected, and I'm doubtful if I will be spending much time out of bed before next weekend. This is what the protest cost me, what I knew it would cost me. I put myself through this and pushed myself to the limit, at risk of serious damage to my health and possible relapse, because opposing the welfare reform bill means that much to me. What I know is that this bill is really badly thought out and will destroy lives. It seems to be a vehicle for ideological cuts that in the end will cost more to clean up than is saved by cutting in the first place. We know and can prove that the government has lied over and over again about the impact of this bill and about who supports it. They have subverted the parliamentary process to force the bill through, and this week they have made the most audacious move yet. They have declared the welfare reform bill to be a money bill, invoking financial privilege to force the bill past the Lords without amendment. But they have declared it to be a money bill after it has already been debated by the House of Lords, and the Lords have already strongly disagreed with it. Had they actually thought that this was a money bill, then the rules dictate that they should have declared it as such before it entered the legislative process. At this point, it looks doubtful whether campaigners can prevent this bill from becoming law. But we will keep fighting. We will make a fuss whenever this causes suffering or even death. We will not let the government get away with this. This is Stephen Sumpter, reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, scientists were surprised this week by the discovery of something they hadn't expected that they'd ever find. Measurements by the Gran Sasso Laboratory in Italy appear to be confirming that we have at last found, objectively, the worst people in the world. Though the findings are yet to be verified by other labs, it does at least initially appear to be true. The online magazine Unilad caught their attention when an article did the rounds that seemed to be advocating, or at least offering, some sort of incitement to commit rape. Essentially though, even discounting this, the magazine looks like the worst thing in the world. The writers on there were using words like lads and banter completely unironically. Now, maybe I'm naive, but isn't student culture the worst thing ever? Why would you possibly think, right, we're going to the pub, so let's go in fancy dress? I remember a few years ago when I was a student, seeing a bunch of people come into the pub all dressed as Deal or No Deal boxes. It was a Tuesday night. But anyway, rather than listen to me moan passive-aggressively about my university experiences, here's Dean Burnett injecting some banter into the show.
Before I start, here are some facts about me that are worth bearing in mind for what I'm about to discuss. Firstly, as you can probably tell from my name and sultry, sexy voice, I am male. I have XY sex chromosomes. Counterintuitively, perhaps, the Y chromosome is quite a weak and feeble chromosome compared to the mighty X. Perhaps this is why us males tend to be so big and aggressive. We're all compensated for small chromosome syndrome. It's like small man syndrome, but it goes right down to the biomolecular level. My being male means I'm probably not a feminist. I support gender equality in all its forms, but feminism is such a broad and diverse ideology these days, as far as I can tell, I'd hesitate to label myself as one due to just ignorance alone. I feel similarly about Jedis. I agree with what they say, I think it would be cool if I was one, I just have no idea how to go about achieving this. Also, being male, I think this makes me immune to any accusations of being a lesbian. You could say there are some lesbians that have hair short as mine or wear the same size boots, but those are just superficial choices that happen to overlap. I'm also a married man whose wife is currently pregnant with our first child, so I can claim to be sexually experienced to a certain degree. And obviously I'm proficient enough with women to have convinced at least one to live with me forever. That may be just be pity on her part, but admittedly you work with what you can. I have also been doing stand-up comedy for about 7 years now, and I've been writing and creating comedy in other formats for almost as long. With a surprising degree of success, considering, you know, I don't really push it that hard. I say it's not to brag, but to demonstrate that I clearly have a sense of humour. It's an odd one, and many would argue that it's a crap one, but I inarguably do have one, that much is obvious. Why am I telling you this? Well, it's in relation to Unilad, a website that became notorious this week, maybe quite briefly, and has now been taken down, for all accounts. I don't know who spotted it first, but it quickly entered the social network sphere via women who were outraged by it. I didn't get to see a great deal of it before it was taken down after a deluge of complaints, but I did see warranted a few raised eyebrows, to say the least. Advertising itself as a guide to being a successful lad, inverted commas, in university, it seemed mainly dedicated to the degradation of women, disabled people, and pretty much anyone who doesn't conform to their masculine ideal via the medium of jokes, let's call them that. One of the passages I read was a bizarrely detailed mathematical analysis of how many women are sluts and how to have sex with them, and ended with the observation that 85% of rapes go unreported, so you're likely to get away with it if you force yourself on a slut, inverted commas, if she ends up rejecting you. Or something like that. I may be mistaken. It's hard to read clearly when your brain is trying to escape through your eye sockets. Obviously, once it became known about, a lot of people had some serious complaints about the Unilad website, and complain they did. The Unilad team, from what I could see, demonstrating reasoning skills in keeping with their writing skills, seemingly resorted to one of three stock responses to the complaints. Number one, accuse the complainer of being a lesbian. Number two, accuse the complainer of being a feminist. Number three, accuse the complainer of having no sense of humour. So, as a heterosexual white male, non-feminist, non-lesbian, working-class background comedian who's been a member of the university for over 10 years, I'm clearly part of what I would consider Unilad's target demographic. And as a comedian, or aspiring comedian, or whatever you want to call me, I clearly possess a sense of humour, as established. So what reason do I have for not liking the Unilad website? In a nutshell, it's crap. From a purely comedy perspective, viewing the whole thing as one big collection of jokes, all the jokes are very poorly thought out and lacking any element of subtlety or nuance that elevates crude jackass-level physicality to genuinely good comedy. Perhaps I'm being unfair. Perhaps there are many men who found Unilad funny. I'm not ruling that out, but I'd imagine they're not the sort of people I want to share a night out with. I mean, I'd probably prefer not to share a country with them. I've heard many feminist friends say that rape jokes are never acceptable, and I respectfully disagree. I can see the arguments for this, I understand the logic, but I don't believe there is such a thing as a subject unsuitable for comedy, as long as it's done right. But a blanket ban is a level of censorship usually employed by totalitarian regimes, when they don't want things being joked about, and they only ever give power to those willing to make the jokes anyway. Again, that's a discussion not really for here. I'm sure other people have had it, and will have again, far more capably than I am. My point was, making jokes about any controversial subject can be funny if it's done well. Unilad, for all their bluster to be humorous and just banter, do not do it well. It's seen as fashionable in comedy these days to be deliberately dark and bad taste, but this isn't that, this is just bad. I've lost count of the number of aspiring young male, and they're always men, stand-ups, who are relatively new to performing, We'll go out in front of an audience of people and casually discuss graphic stories about rape, paedophilia, murder, racism, and Lord knows what else. Bad Taste Comedy has been around for a long time now. From the shock comics like Frankie Boyle and the stalwarts of Bad Taste Comedy like Jerry Sadowitz, or the Americans like Doug Stanhope. Comics that use bad taste and push boundaries, like Boyle, Carr, and many others, have become more successful in recent years, and this has had a questionable effect on the comedy scene. It means you can get away with more now, as people are more familiar with controversial statements or material intended to shock, thus widening the areas of what is acceptable to talk about. But on the downside, you get this slew of imitators who can see these comics becoming famous for saying these horrible things and decide that they can do that too. But they usually miss the point entirely. Whatever you think about Frankie Boyle and Jimmy Carr and all those people like that, it's hard to deny they are good at what they do. They are successful. They make people laugh at things they know they shouldn't laugh at. And there's the key. You can say shocking things, controversial things, anything you like, as long as it's funny. I know funny is a subjective measure, but it's often obvious to see where an attempt to induce humour has been made, even if you think it's an unsuccessful attempt. But where many young comics, and you in particular, seem to go wrong, is assuming that offending people is an end in and of itself in comedy, when it really isn't. Rather than putting some effort into constructing some well-thought-out jokes, they just say some offensive statements and count the audience's shock reaction as a successful response. But it isn't a success on the comedian's part, any more than getting booed and having bottles of urine thrown at you is a success if you're a stand-up. It's just lazy and short-sighted. Many others use an excuse that particularly gets on my nerves when they say that what they're doing is challenging people's politically correct preconceptions. Why? Why is that a good thing? Why is that a thing that needs doing? I don't deny that political correctness can be ham-fisted and over the top quite regularly, but I'd say it's by far the lesser of two evils. To me, the phrase political correctness has gone mad is often an alternative way of saying I resent being made to feel guilty about my bigotry. That doesn't apply to everyone who uses the phrase, of course, but its repeated use suits the needs of those who do mean that. The phrase itself has such negative connotations, suggesting that if it wasn't for self-serving busybodies, we'd all be regularly using racial slurs and oppressing people, and everyone would be happier for it, paradoxically. So why do politically correct preconceptions need challenging? Are you going to come to my house and invite in next, and knock out some load-bearing walls, under the premise of challenging my architectural preconceptions? How about you try saying something funny before attempting to undermine the accepted norms of society for questionable reasons? Run before you can walk and all that. But however much I might criticise these comics, I can't fault them for having the courage of their convictions and getting up on stage and saying these things. I may well be the one who is wrong. And as far as I'm aware, though, that's not something you and lad have ever done. They're not exactly anonymous, perhaps, but they prefer to convey their horrible attempts at humour via the safety of the internet, where anyone who's offended is likely to be many, many miles away. One of the rules of the world of comedy is that it's a bad comic who automatically blames their audience. It's a wonderful example of cognitive dissonance. A comic must think that either they're not funny, or every single person in a room full of people is wrong, and they go for the latter. It's worrying that they do it so often. Union Lad's first line of defence was to blame the audience, always a bad sign. You could argue that people complaining about Union Lad weren't its target audience at all. Well, that's tough. You write deliberately offensive comedy and put it out in the public domain. You have to be prepared for people who don't like it. You don't get to cherry-pick your audience in advance. That's not how it works. I think it was Robin Ince who once said that, if challenged about something you said for comedy effect, you should have a stronger defence than it's just a joke. If you don't, then it's not a justification. If you truly believe that what you say is harmless fun, then you should have the guts to defend it. You know, that just took down their whole website when challenged. But it didn't come across as harmless banter. It came across as classic behaviour of bullies, victimising someone for their own amusement, and to make themselves feel big, and when the victims finally turn, accuse them of being unable to take a joke. Having your testosterone cake and eating it isn't an option, it seems. So in summary, Unilad claimed that their material was just harmless fun and jokes. If this is the case, the problem still stands that their attempts at comedy were dreadful, nowhere near amusing enough to make up for the horrific bile and misogyny they contained. So even if it was all a big joke, you still did something wrong. That's not really an excuse. You are, of course, free to look at my comedy output online, and odds are you'll find it terrible, all nerdy and weird and just crap, but that's fine. But my comedy victimises no one, but myself and the individuals who probably don't exist. And if anyone has been upset or offended by anything I've said so far, then don't worry, I'm just joking. That's how this works, right? This is Dean Manette for The Pod Delusion.
Now, the old saying goes that it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt. That's why the Liberal Democrats haven't been fun since Nick forgot how to smile. But anyway, what if you want to count how many people got hurt? It might be trickier than you think, as Georgia Gayle Grant has been finding out.
You may have seen or heard a story on Tuesday about how the rate of deaths in police custody is higher than admitted. I'm one of those people who think that if the rate of deaths in police custody is anything other than zero, then it's not okay. But I'm sure there are lots of reasons that I don't understand why it's fine to restrain people until they stop breathing. According to the Independent Police Complaints Commission, there were 16 cases of restraint-related deaths in police custody between 1998 and 2009. Recently, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, following months of protracted argument and Freedom of Information Act requests, finally received the data upon which this figure was based. There were 86 names on this list, all of whom died in situations where restraint was used but was not necessarily a direct cause of death. The short list of 16 was those where restraint was used and was a direct cause of death. However, the Bureau, true to their name, did a bit more investigation and found that there were lots of other cases, ones available in the public domain, where restraint by the police clearly played a role in the death, but they were not listed on either the list of 16 or on the long list of 86. This included Simon Bosworth, who died after police restrained him, possibly while he was having an epileptic fit. It was serious enough for the IPCC to conduct their own investigation into his death. And in fact, a quick Google search of the news on Tuesday brings up articles from The Independent, The Guardian, the BBC and several others, all listing examples of people who have died at least partly as a result of restraint by the police and yet are omitted from this list. Roger Sylvester, for example, who died in hospital after being restrained by 8 officers, Giles Freeman, Andrew Jordan. I decided to do a bit of research myself and came across the charity Inquest, who keep statistics on deaths in police custody, deaths in prisons, and unlawful killing prosecutions and verdicts. They derive these figures from their own monitoring and casework. An inquest is carried out after every death where the police are involved and these are reported. The figures that Inquest produce are independent of those produced by the Home Office, IPCC and other government agencies. I can't comment about their methods of collection or indeed their accuracy, but let us assume, for the sake of argument, that these figures do genuinely represent the experience of those working in the charity. There's a link to the statistics on the Pod Delusion website, but I'll summarise them now. According to Inquest, since 1990 there have been 1,423 deaths in police custody or following contact with the police. The number of deaths in custody was highest in recent years in 2003, when there were 65 deaths in custody. The figure has been steadily dropping ever since, apart from 2011, when there was again a spike to 21 deaths. The 1,423 figure also includes deaths from police shootings, in pursuits and in road traffic incidents. These make up a third of that total figure, and have remained broadly constant over the last 10 years. Looking at the 1998 to 2009 period, the IPCC figure of 16 referred to, there were 491 deaths in police custody. Even allowing that some of those won't be restraint-related, that isn't even in the same ballpark. So what is going on? Well, it turns out that the IPCC has an extremely tight definition of in custody. It's only counted as a death in custody when the person in question has been arrested or detained under the Mental Health Act. When I was studying the tiny bit of criminal legal procedure I had to study to be called to the bar, I learned that there was quite a lot that could lawfully happen before arrest and charge, especially if a suspect was on the move or resisting arrest. Postulating wildly, and if an expert on the matter could correct me, I would be delighted, I would think that restraint quite often occurs before arrest. In order to tell someone you're arresting them, you have to have them still enough to do so. Tom Burke, the head of analytical services at the IPCC, was not able to provide the Bureau with the number of restraint-related deaths following contact with the police over the same time period, although, as reported in the Bureau's article, he did say that looking into this was something the IPCC was seriously considering doing in the next financial year, which I'm delighted by, although quite astonished that they didn't have these figures at their fingertips already. It goes without saying that the police do a difficult and important job, and I'm grateful for them. I'm lucky enough to have had minimal contact with the police, most recently when I foolishly and glaringly illegally jumped a red light on my trusty bike right in front of the Chinese embassy, where there is a 24-hour police guard stationed. The chap in question waved me over, and I narrowly escaped a fine by saying, "It's a fair cop." But that's not important. What is important is that the full information should be available to the public. Reducing the numbers of deaths following contact with the police should not be achieved by changing the parameters of the reported figures. It should be achieved through research, teaching, and culture shifts. I think the Home Office, or the IPCC, should report the total figure for deaths following contact with the police and then break it down by category. Maybe 16 is the right figure for one very specific type of restraint-related death. What bothers me is that until these higher figures are made public, no one is being held responsible, and the public can't really make informed judgments about changes in policing policy or how these changes affect deaths in custody. There must be a high level of trust between individual and state for the system to work. And this perceived lack of transparency and accountability damaged that trust. Publicising how many people die following contact with the police and then explaining those numbers can, in my opinion, only lead to better and safer policing. This has been Georgia Gale Grant, apologising for not being cheery, for the Pod Delusion.
Now onto a more cheerful topic, the possibility of nuclear war. A theatre in London has a whole season of events about nuclear stuff coming up. And to find out more, here's Liz Luckendorf.
If any of you have been to the Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn, North London, you'll know it's not your average theatre. In February and March this year, the Tricycle is putting on quite an audacious programme. The Tricycle is going nuclear. With plays, films, exhibitions, comedy nights, and much more, the Tricycle is challenging its audience to think about the bomb. Nicholas Kent has been the artistic director of the Tricycle Theatre for the past 28 years, and this is his final programme for the theatre. I had a chat with him early on Sunday morning about the programme. I first asked, where did the idea come from?
We always do political plays, or we do things that respond to big political issues. And some years ago, we did a series of plays about Afghanistan, charting the history of Afghanistan using 12 playwrights. And then after that, we did another similar type of show with a number of playwrights about women power and politics, looking at why there were so few women represented in the British Parliament, which we did to coincide with the last election. At one of those performances, Shirley Williams, who had special responsibility for arms proliferation under the Gordon Brown government, started to talk to me about the fact that the Trident Commission was coming up at that time, and the first gate and the second gate commission would come up in 2014, and she thought this was an enormously important issue, and she persuaded me that it would be a very good subject for theatre to look at. So I thought about it a great deal and then realised that actually my entire lifetime had been lived in the shadow of the bomb, in that I was born in the same year as the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I remember being at school during the Cuban Missile Crisis, during the worries about nuclear testing, and all those sorts of things. So, and obviously now with the current danger of Iran, North Korea, and the possibility of a bomb falling into terrorist hands, I felt that this was a subject that we really should try and dunk the debate of and make people talk and debate it a little bit more before the country committed to spending a vast amount of our budget on Trident.
There's so many aspects to, I guess it's more of a festival than just a program. How do you get from this idea to organizing something around such a huge topic? Because there's so many facets to it.
Well, you start reading and researching, and I've obviously read a number of histories on the bomb. I'm sort of trying to understand a bit about nuclear physics, getting absolutely nowhere, but trying. And I'm also been talking to a huge amount of people, both in America and here. Quite interesting, the attitudes towards proliferation. If you talk to people here about nuclear proliferation, they immediately think about CND, about whether we should give up nuclear weapons, about the morality of proliferation and those sort of issues. If you mention nuclear proliferation in the States, the immediate reaction is, well, we've got to stop everyone else getting the bomb and it proliferating. So there's sort of very different attitudes both sides of the Atlantic. So there are a whole lot of things. So our cinema, which seats 300 people, quite a large cinema, our theatre, which seats 230, and our gallery, which a lot of people can come through, are all being focused during February and March on nuclear issues.
Just to go back a bit earlier to something you said, from my perspective, I've kind of taken the idea that there won't be any kind of nuclear war for granted, and there's no logic or reason behind that. I guess we're still used to this Cold War thing, so the Cold War powers have settled down, so there's no problem. Will something like this festival give me a new perspective on that and educate me to the more relevant dangers for this point in time?
I hope so, yes. I think all of us, after the end of the Cold War, thought, oh, well, we can park the nuclear issue. But I think we very much can't park the nuclear issue. There are many too many nuclear warheads around. The world should be continuously looking at ways of getting nations to disarm. But this policy of sort of just letting everything go by default, I think, is a really dangerous policy. And we should actively be, you know, campaigning to get the world to reduce nuclear arms, something very much that we can do and would actually selfishly, from a British point of view, have a very good effect, because what is the point of our producing, you know, another Trident and spending all that money when we could be spending it on education, health, science, all sorts of things? Mutually assured destruction is of only any relevance if people are actually frightened by it. And some of the terrorists or rogue nations that might get hold of a bomb, that deterrence may well not operate.
Do you think other theatres, like national theatres, would be able to do things like this? And why aren't more doing so?
Well, I don't know why I'm more doing so. I think a national theatre every now and again does do things, and the RSC does do things. I suppose we've been consistently a campaigning theatre for the past 20 years or so. And it's just something we've taken as our mission.
If you can leave us with a little bit of what the plays are going to be about.
Yes, and with great pleasure. And the plays are both challenging, thought-provoking, and very entertaining, and actually very funny in many ways. The first part starts in 1940, when two scientists, not British scientists, but scientists working in Britain, who are emigres from Vienna and Berlin, and they both discover that it is possible to create a bomb with not many, many, many tons of uranium, which was the thing that Niels Bohr thought, but that you can create it with enough uranium for a few kilograms of uranium could actually make a bomb. And they present this fact to the British establishment, and that's the story of the first play. Then we have the story of the British government deciding after the bomb explosion on Hiroshima and Nagasaki whether to develop their own nuclear bomb, and the history of that development. And then we go forward as to whether India should sign the non-proliferation treaty or they should develop their bomb. We look at the proliferation to a number of different countries, the nuclear club that the Americans set up, and it's all done through a metaphor of gentle stuff, very funny satire about the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And then we go through to the Ukraine after the collapse of the USSR and the communist empire. That's one evening, or if you want to see it every weekend, that's an afternoon. And then the second part is more about Iran, North Korea, Israel, the dangers in the Middle East now, and also about the letter of last resort, which is the letter that the British Prime Minister has to write, giving the orders to the commander of the submarine, the Trident submarine, as to what he should do in the event of Britain being wiped out. So there's the dilemma of what you write in that letter. And then the last play is about an arms inspection by the IAEA in Iran. So it's a sort of real mixed bunch, but some of the plays are very funny and quite satirical. All of them are thought-provoking, and I think you'll learn a lot by coming, and I think you'll have a very enjoyable time.
We'll make sure to put links up to all of this on our website so people can come enjoy the plays, and I want to go to, like, every single film, because they're all films I've wanted to see but have never seen.
Well, they're all wonderful films. I think a lot of the films are absolutely terrific. Films like On the Beach was absolutely extraordinary, and I would counsel you to go to that. And also, do go and see Dr. Strangelove. And there are things like Duck and Cover, the civil defence films. There's a whole lot of films I would like to see, too.
If you'd like to find out more about the Tricycle Ghost nuclear programme, there are links on the Podillusion website, alongside the full-length interview with Nicholas Kent. We'll be doing some more work with the Tricycle over the next few months, so stay tuned if you haven't got your fill of the heady mix of arts and nuclear science. This has been Liz Luchtendorf for the Podillusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to over 2 years of podcast archives, as well as many extras on the Poddelusion Extra feed. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website, if you enjoy the Poddelusion, why not support us in what we do? You can make a one-off donation or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. The Poddelusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Stephen Sumter, Dean Burnett, Georgia Gale Grant, Tom Williamson, and me, James O'Malley. The Sketch in a Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Poddelusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Jaguar sweeps into the quadrangle at Buckingham Palace. The car, coming to a standstill, he gets out and with his head bowed, Sir Fred Goodwin enters for his audience with the Queen. Only one voice can be heard from an upstairs window, that of His Royal Highness, the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip.
Oi, you tit!
Sir Fred Goodwin, as he still is until the knighthood is officially rescinded by royal decree, walks alone down what must be a very lonely, but nonetheless beautiful, Rococo-style hall to meet his fate. All is still and quiet. No pomp, no triumphant trumpets, only the sound of a ticking grandfather clock, and from a hidden alcove, His Royal Highness, Prince Philip.
Loser!
So now, Sir Fred approaches Her Majesty. He stops and kneels as he did once before, but under happier circumstances. Her Majesty steps forward with no emotion shown on her face, and from a small silver receptacle produces the shitty stick of shame.
With all the powers of one's throne, I do wipe on your head and shoulders the shitty stick of shame. Arise, Fred, pleb of this sceptred isle.
Fred, as he now is, walks the hallway, shamed and chastened before the Commonwealth, a member of the Great Unwashed. Although, with a £700,000 annual pension, some would argue that even the shitty stick of shame is not enough to beat the wide grin from his smug face.
Good point. Release one's corgis.
That'll teach you. Look at him run. Come on, Liz, we're on a roll now. Let's send for Geoffrey Archer and Jonathan Aiken. Oh, what fun!